Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everybody, to the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and we are going to talk about evil tonight. This is part of the series that I've been promising that about every 2 months, we're going to take on philosophical issues. We'll leave the cultural stuff behind. Certainly, we're going to engage Mormonism and day-to-day living and things like that as we talk about this. But a lot of our listeners have expressed a desire to learn more about philosophy and classic issues within it. And so we did pragmatism a couple months ago. This is going to be the problem of evil, which we'll explain a little bit more as we go. I want to do the mind-body problem. I want to introduce process theology. Send us your topics that you'd like us to cover in sort of our philosophy series, which we'll do about every 7 or 8 weeks. I'm excited to have with us a podcast veteran, Jennifer Finlinson-Fife. Jennifer, do you remind everybody about your background?
I grew up in Vermont, one of 8 children, and I went to BYU, and I got my PhD in counseling psychology from Boston College. I wrote my dissertation on Mormon women and sexuality, specifically looking at women's agency in the sexual realm. I'm a therapist, and I work with couples primarily around sexuality issues, but work with individuals also. Private practice in Chicago, Illinois.
Great. Thank you for being on. You're in many ways, I mean, you're the odd person out in this podcast as the non-philosopher, non-theologian, but I'm so excited to have you to really talk about how these ideas translate into real lives, and especially people who, in many cases that you work with, who are in quite a bit of pain from various evils that are in their lives.
Yeah.
So we're grateful to have that. And you're also our jargon police, so if we get a little too wonky or something, let us know.
Okay, great.
Jim McLaughlin, welcome back to the podcast. Love having you. I just had lunch with somebody on Saturday. He says your podcast, the one that you and I did over at Mormon Stories, was his favorite. He's listened to it 2 or 3 times, and he was so thrilled to hear that you're on this week. So welcome back.
Oh, thanks, Dan. It's good to be back. I grew up in Salt Lake City, well, in Taylorsville. Wanted to be a farmer. Realized that I would starve to death if I was a farmer, so I decided I'd go to school. Served a mission in France, got interested in philosophy, came back here and did a PhD in philosophy, in religious studies, philosophy of religion at the University of Toronto. Wrote my dissertation on the desire to be God in Sartre and Berdyaev. It was something that came to me during priesthood meeting once. We all want to be God, and that seemed like there must be a nice way to do that instead of a kind of send the ladder of success way. I was trying to figure that out. I teach philosophy and religion now at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee, North Carolina. We're out in the Smoky Mountains, beautiful place, and if you ever saw the Deliverance, you saw our town.
All right. Very cool. And Jim's our process theologian as well as I am. So when we do that one, we'll definitely try to get you back. Lloyd Erickson, welcome to the podcast for the first time. You're a name known to, I think, quite a few people in Facebook circles and whatnot that hang around these things. But would you tell us a bit more about your background?
Yeah, I grew up in Utah, got my undergrad in philosophy at Utah Valley University with a minor in religious studies. And then I went to Claremont Graduate University, where you went to get a degree in philosophy, a master's degree in philosophy of religion and theology. And I'm currently writing my thesis right now, actually on the problem of evil, and looking at how LDS philosophers have tried to give a Mormon response to the problem of evil. And I'm also currently the managing editor at Greg Coford Books. Busy there.
I was going to mention that. And definitely, I was aware of your thesis, so I'm excited to have you on. I wanted you on anyway for other things, but and you know, one of the things about that I love about you, Lloyd, is weren't you publishing even as an undergrad? It seemed like you have presented at conferences and just been a productive scholar for a long, long time.
Yeah, Lloyd and I did a book together.
Yeah, the very first, when the Society for Mormon Philosophy and Theology started, Jim and I edited the proceedings from that initial conference.
Right, that's right. Anyway, I just really admire guys like you that just been right in there in the mix during school, so that's awesome.
It's fun. It makes the school a little more difficult, though, which is why I'm still working on my thesis.
Hey, well, I'm excited to dive in, and Lloyd, we introduced you last, but our plan was to throw to you first. If you don't mind just giving an overview of the problem of evil as it's laid out, and you know, even the history of it and why this is such a problem for many people with traditional views about God. Let's overview the problem of evil before we really deal with any Mormon angles on it.
All right. Well, the problem of evil, the basic problem of evil, what they call the logical problem of evil, deals with the traditional absolute understandings of God. So they want to say that God is omnipotent, all-powerful, omniscient, all-knowing, omnibenevolent, all-good, and yet this question of evil still existing with that kind of God is the logical problem there. And it basically goes down to if God is all-knowing, then God is certainly aware of the possibility of evils, future evils, evils occurring. If God is all power, then God has the ability, he has the power to prevent these evils or to stop them from happening. And if God is all good, if God is this morally benevolent, you know, a truly loving God, then God would have the desire to prevent those evils. And yet any quick observation of the world lets us know that evils exist. You know, and examples of these can go anywhere from, you know, a hot summer day, four young girls are playing hide and seek and hide in a trunk of a car, and here they are cooking in the sun, in the summer sun, and they're going to die a very painful death. And God knows this is going on because he's all knowing. He has the power to unlatch this lock. He's all good, so he desires. He doesn't want these girls to suffer and die, and yet these kind of things happen on and on. Other examples, you know, more tragic is someone, a young girl walking home from school being kidnapped and raped. And the same situation, God knows what's going on. He's got the power to prevent it, and he desires to do it. And yet these things still happen on. And even worse, you look at major tragedies, like the classic example most philosophers look at is the Holocaust. That's the essential question is, how could God allow this Holocaust to happen? How could God allow Hitler to do all this when he clearly knows about it, is able to stop it, desires to do it, and yet doesn't do it for some reason?
And this is the logical problem of evil when you assert all the omnis.
Yeah.
So it's the classical theist, absolutist God. And so it doesn't mean that every theology, every religion faces the problem the same way. It's simply when you assert all three of those things, what you said becomes problematic.
Yeah, and just to add, with God being all-powerful, one of the big issues that's looked at as well is power isn't just the power to prevent evil, but as God as the creator in traditional Christian thought and traditional theology for the generally, if God is the creator, then why did God create a world when he knows these kind of things are going to happen as well? So it's both
exactly
with power is both the ability to stop it and why create it in the first place.
Perfect. Jim, you're good. You're probably handy with your David Hume statement.
I have my David Hume quote right in front of me from the Dialogues on Natural Religion. Either God would remove evil out of this world and cannot, or he can and will not, or he has not the power nor will, or lastly, he has both the power and the will. If he has the will and not the power, this shows weakness, which is contrary to the nature of God. If he has the power and not the will, it is a malignity, which is no less contrary to his nature. If he is neither able nor willing, he is both impotent and malignant, and consequently cannot be God. If he is both willing and able, which alone is consonant to the nature of God, whence comes evil, and why does he not prevent it?
Awesome.
A couple of things, you know, Lloyd really laid this out nicely, but, you know, the idea, too, is that, you know, God is absolutely perfect as God is. So there's a sense that, as Lloyd said, God didn't need the world. God didn't need to create the world, but God created it, sometimes people will say, out of an abundance of love. Yet the world has all these problems. So, you know, that's been the traditional problem for mainly for Christians, Muslims, and Jews who are traditional theists. And then you also throw in the idea that there are really two types of evil. Well, actually, there's three. Moral evil, you know, sin, human-caused evil. But then, you know, there's stuff we don't do. You know, there's natural evil, you know, the babies born with spina bifida, or, you know, all the things that torment humans, and not just humans, but animals. And then finally, there's one that people don't talk about too much, the metaphysical evil, the fact that we just aren't perfect. God didn't make, you know, we're made as good as God seems to have been able to make us, but we're not like God.
Now, you have a great, it's probably too long to read the whole thing, but your Mark Twain quote is pretty much in your face about that particular piece of it.
Yeah, Mark Twain is great on this. If you want to really enjoy this, I recommend the listeners to go to the last page of Mark Twain's The Mysterious Stranger, where he just, it is one of the most dismal books you'll ever read, but you last quote.
Well, let's at least read a few of the lines here. It's God who could make good children as easily as bad, yet preferred to make bad ones. Could have made every one of them happy, but never made a single happy one. Who made them prize their bitter life, let stingily cut it short. And it goes on like that. So yeah, it definitely names what you were talking about.
Yeah, I since you did that. Who mouths justice and invented hell, mouths mercy and invented hell, mouths rules and forgiveness multiplied 70 times 7 and invented hell. Mouths morals to other people and has none himself. Who frowns upon crimes yet commits them all. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's too good a quote. Well, I'll do this. I'll at least throw this quote up on the website, so that'll be fun for folks. So, okay, good. So we've done a really good job with the problem of evil, at least as the logical problem. Lloyd, there's a term in philosophy called theodicy. Would you explain what that term is? And that will take us a little bit into now we've posed the problem. Let's kind of start moving into the defenses of God or the different ways that either theologians who still want to maintain the classic view of God do, or else how other religions sort of come at it so that the logical problem no longer exists.
All right. Well, there's kind of two different ways that theologians traditionally respond to the problem of evil. And one is a defense. And the defense is basically just to say, look, there's no problem in the first place. The logic that you think is going on, if you really delve into it, if you understand God better, you'll see that there's no problem at all. And then you've got a theodicy. And a theodicy, I mean, they're somewhat similar, and they're often grouped together, but a theodicy also tries to not just say there isn't a problem, but tries to say, here is why God allows evil. So it's not just saying there's not a problem at all, but God actually utilizes evil for some reason, or God allows it. There's a reason that God actively allows evils to exist.
Good. That's a good start. Why don't you take us wherever you want to go into either one of those?
All right. Well, one of the most popular defenses is what is often called the free will defense. And this is actually utilized a lot in LDS theology as well, but free will defense, made most popular by a philosopher at Notre Dame by the name of Alvin Plantinga. And the free will defense basically says, look, free will is an important value for humans to have. It's a good in itself for humans. And God realizes, and God, you know, God knows that it's good for humans to be free, for humans to be able to freely love God in return. And so God created humans so that they were free. And true freedom involves the actual ability for humans to choose moral sin if they choose to do that, to hurt another person, to cause evil, cause suffering, if that is what they choose to do. And so the main defense says, look, there's not a problem here because evils in the world can be explained as a result of this good free will that humans use for wrong purposes. And you know, and someone want to critique that and say, well, why didn't God just create people so that they can freely do something, they can freely do good all the time, and that they only choose to do good? And Plantinga and others who evoke the free will defense will say, well, that's not real freedom then. And so, again, the argument is because freedom is such a good for humans, and because God wants humans to be able to love, and love requires, true love requires freedom, then that is an explanation of how evils exist in the world. They're just a byproduct of this good that God decided was best for humans to have.
Okay, so that's an important one. Let's not critique it yet. Let's go ahead and introduce the others.
All right, and then with the theodicies, probably one of the biggest one is what they often call Iranian philosophy by the early Christian theologian Irenaeus. And the idea here is that God not just allows evils to happen, but allows them for good reasons. And some of the reasons are, the biggest one is the idea of soul building, and that in order for human spirits to become greater, to become more moral, to become more like God, to become more holy, they have to be able to, one, make moral choices, and two, respond to suffering and evils in the world in moral ways. And so not only is evil a byproduct of human free will, but God wants evils to exist in the world so that, one, we can choose to not do those evils, and two, so if those evils exist, we can respond to them. We can be good Samaritans. We can be charitable people. We can be loving beings, and we can learn by those and strength and become stronger by those and become more holy or more divine through that process of our experience with suffering.
Excellent. And those will sound familiar to a lot of Mormons, both of those, right?
Yes.
We hear that in our discourse. Jim, is there anything you'd want to add in at this point on theodicy?
Yeah, Lloyd referred to this, the kind of idea of a defense. But also to, if we go back, the kind of founder of the tradition, I guess Irenaeus comes before Augustine, but Augustine lays out the majority position, which is one that you hear people use all the time. You know, you'll have, and we all do it. Somebody loses a loved one, or something really, really horrible happens, and people want to come up to you and say, well, this is all part of God's plan. And as if Augustine describes this as if it's this great painting, and God is the artist of the universe. And matter of fact, he even says at one point, we are like people ignorant of a painting who complain that the colors are not beautiful everywhere in the picture, but the artist has laid the appropriate tint on every spot. So some of us are in the light parts of the painting, and others of us are in the dark parts of the painting. And that's what somebody like Mark Twain is really ticked off about.
Right.
But also it's a powerful idea. I mean, if you read somebody like Dante or C.S. Lewis or Rumi, the Muslim poet, or for me, I've always had a hard time understanding this because I teach a lot of, traditionally Christian kids. But I've been showing the film, a great Catholic film director, Robert Bresson, made this film, Diary of a Country Priest, based on Georges Bernanos's novel back in the 20s. And it's a powerful idea. There's a point in the film where the priest speaks to this countess who has lost her son and pretty much tells her that our freedom is to accept the world that God has given us, and accept the idea that it's beautiful. And whether or not you want to go that way, it's a powerful idea that has appealed to a lot of people.
Good. That's helpful to bring in. Lloyd, one of the things I wanted you to do soon, and so maybe this is the thing, in some ways what Jim has just described as the Augustinian way of dealing with is sort of the assault upon the reality of evil. Mm-hmm. of the three assertions. Genuine evil exists, God is all powerful, God is all good. If those are the three of the triangle, this one is sort of a, well, guys, it's really not evil because we need the darkness in order to bring out the light. And if you see it from God's perspective, it's this. And we sort of get that sort of approach. Again, it isn't a classical problem of evil for Buddhists or for Eastern folks, but in many ways, do one of you want to kind of elaborate a little bit on how that corner of the triangle is often dealt with in other religions?
Well, Augustine, you know, in the Confessions, comes out and says that explicitly. He says, you know, from your point of view, you know, because the Confessions are like prayers, there is no evil. Because all of it, a man's evil purposes, evil actions can be brought into God's good purposes. Now, you look at Eastern traditions, I mean, the problem of evil is different there. It's almost more a practical problem than it is a logical or evidential problem, like it is for Christians, Muslims, and Jews who believe in one all-powerful God. And one reason for this is, take Buddhism, for instance. The gods are not important in Buddhism, especially classical Buddhism, but you know, the Four Noble Truths that the Buddha teaches are, one, that to exist is to suffer. So what do you do about that? And, you know, the second noble truth, well, suffering, you know, comes from desire. And the third noble truth, well, you know, if you end desire, you end suffering. There's an incredible film, Yoshijiro Ozu's Tokyo Story, in which, you know, because actually the word for suffering is something much closer to disappointment, that nothing stays the same. The world is impermanent. And there's
right.
a wonderful scene in that film where an old man loses his wife, and he's standing out watching the sunrise, and he says, it was a beautiful sunrise, it's going to be a hot day. That's his, that he's got to accept this. He's got to accept the world the way it is and kind of go with it, that suffering's part of it. And there's something actually beautiful about that suffering.
Good, good. So, yeah, and a little bit more on the Buddhist sort of angle. It is this desire to control things that are uncontrollable, to hold static, and when the world's in process, those are the kinds of things that it means by desire,
yeah.
right? And that's, and so we create our own suffering. So there's this famous line, samsara, which is nirvana, which is the, nirvana and samsara are the same. Yeah, so samsara is the world of suffering, pain, and death, and nirvana is the heaven, and it's the same thing. It's just a matter of your perspective, your willingness to view it one way or the other.
And there's a certain similarity there. We could talk about differences quite a bit, but there's a certain similarity there to Augustine. If you think of the Bresson film that I just mentioned, of, you know, you have to embrace the world even with all its suffering. Of course, you know, the Buddhists would not have, you know, God creating it so you could suffer. It's just there. It's a fact. This is what you deal with.
Exactly. But as far as human beings, the classical problem of evil isn't, it's only there for those that want to do the omni everything God and assert the reality of evil. And so Augustine's is certainly one of the approaches. Lloyd, you're either welcome to continue on to expand there, or go to one of the other two prongs of the thing and kind of at least share how either certain Christians or other religious traditions kind of get out of the problem of evil, at least the classical, logical problem of evil.
Yeah, one approach is through certain process theology. And Dan, you know much more about this than I do, but the basic idea is that God isn't all powerful in this traditional sense, but rather God's power is a power of persuasion. And this idea is that, and it basically comes down to saying, look, God simply doesn't have the omni power to prevent, just to simply go in and stop these things. Rather, God can only persuade humans, or even persuade the universe, to try to persuade the universe to not do these evil things. And so you have that sense. Another certain approach tied with the free will defense is a branch that tries to say, well, God just doesn't have an absolute knowledge of the future. And so God simply, because of free will, God can't know everything that's going to happen. But God simply looks at the world as it currently is, and using his, you know, mastermind and abilities that sociology and anthropology and everything to know human nature, works his way as best as he can to try to prevent those evils, but
or mitigate the negative consequences,
to lessen them
as much
as possible,
right?
And to utilize, to recognize, okay, evils are existing. You know, how can I then use these evils for further good?
Yeah, to transmute, to make lemonade out of lemons. Yeah, and so this is the classic chess master
sort of approach there, that God, you know, doesn't necessarily exactly know what the opponent in the chess match is going to do, but always has a move that will lead to the optimal possible outcome, given whatever happens, right?
Yeah, and there's another fascinating theodicy that kind of comes out of the Holocaust, and it goes a direction most theologians don't want to go, and it questions God's goodness,
right?
And recognizes, and it's often called protest theology, a theodicy, because it's protesting against God. It's saying, God, you are all powerful, you are all knowing, and yet you allowed these things to happen. Shape up, you know? Mm-hmm. How dare you? And is in a lot of ways, it's a really interesting approach. It's a kind of approach to say, God, time to repent. It sounds kind of funny, but it really comes out of the Holocaust, where people were faced with this horrible reality they were in, and wanting to maintain a belief that there is some divine structure, a divinity out there that is still controlling the universe, and basically calling out, you know, shaking their fist at God, and saying, you know, darn you, God, how dare you, you know, stop.
Yeah, fantastic. And of course, that comes a little bit, you know, certainly the roots of that were within the Jewish tradition, where you're constantly in dialogue with God, and it was okay to tell God why you think, you know, your lot in life is screwed and stuff. So, but you're right, the Holocaust has brought that up.
One thing I wanted to mention, if you want to read a really nice literary version of what Lloyd just talked about, there's a couple of nice things there. You know, there actually was a Jewish Gnostic movement after the destruction of the temple. The Second Temple and the Bar Kokhba rebellion that questioned the goodness of God. But then Elie Wiesel has written a wonderful play. It's not one that we read that much. It's called The Trial of God, in which after a pogrom during the festival of Purim, they put God on trial, and his God's defender is Satan. It's only Satan would do theodicy, whereas the faithful person is questioning the goodness of God.
Awesome.
God like that.
That there's actually something very powerful with that.
And then, you'll get Emmanuel Levinas also writing an essay called Useless Suffering, where it accuses theodicists as being a part of the problem of evil. Because in theodicy, we try and explain away the suffering of other people to give it a purpose. He says that's okay to do for yourself, but you can't do it for your neighbor.
Mm-hmm. Very good, very good.
Yeah, going along with that, an approach to the problem of evil that I'm very much interested in is by D.Z. Phillips, who used to be at Claremont before he passed away. And he's very much influenced. I mean, he's a Wittgensteinian. And in Wittgenstein, he plays off a quote by Wittgenstein, where Wittgenstein says that what is ragged should be left ragged in the world. And by this, Wittgenstein is very critical of philosophy coming in and trying to intrude itself on human life and how we live our lives. And so what D.Z. Phillips says, one of his criticisms is that these theodicists come in and try to explain evil. And his criticism is that in doing that, they're ultimately creating more problems, or either creating more problems or trying to define life in a way that is completely foreign to how we actually live it.
Can you say a little bit more about that? What means by
is,
that?
Is his one of his criticisms is theodicists, they come in and they try to make the world perfect. They want to be able to say that every problem in the world has a reason. Every suffering, every bit of suffering in the world, God has a reason for that to happen. Everything is going to play out perfectly in the end. You know, often the term is used as God is the great chess master who is playing this masterful game of chess in the world, and knowing, and every move is a calculated move to achieve that end that he has in mind.
Mm-hmm. And that increases suffering just because, that was the piece, it increases suffering because it actually imposes a meaning that undermines the suffering or undermines.
Yeah, it undermines it because it doesn't allow those who are suffering to suffer
right.
in a real way. It demeans their suffering to a certain extent. It demeans their experience.
Okay, thanks. We're doing really well here. I just want to throw one more You know, again, we have the triangle of a perfectly loving God and a perfectly powerful God and an evil, genuine evil existing. There, we've shown how some mitigated against the reality of evil. It's only evil from a certain perspective. Some have questioned God's power. And we're talking about process theology there, and I'm going to hint now that that's generally where Mormons go too. So we'll go back to there. But then there's the besides the protest theology, which challenges God's goodness, there is a dualist approach, which says that basically, hey, God isn't all good because there's an all evil God in addition to the all good God. And basically the reason for evil is this war between competing gods that are equally as powerful. So in this case, you'd be in the camp of the Zoroastrians. And Jim, who else in religion dualist?
It's been a long tradition. I mean, in a way, you could look at some of the Gnostics as kind of getting close to that, in that you have, you know, the soul's good, the body's evil, the Manichaeans.
Evil. Right, that's what I meant, the Manichaeans. That's who I was forgetting.
Manichaeans are there. I mean, the Zoroastrians, depends which group of Zoroastrians you look at, but you've got Ormazda and Ahriman, or, right, you know, that come up. Within Christian tradition, you have the Bogomils in Eastern Europe that do this. And if you go to France and you're around Toulouse and you look, go up in the mountains and you see these incredible fortresses where nobody could have built anything, they're so high up. Well, those are old Albigensian or Qatari castles. And there was in the 14th century, there was a crusade against these people because they were regarded as heretics by the church, the Catholic Church, and eventually were pretty well annihilated, except when I was a missionary there, I ran into two or three people who claimed to be Cathars. Or if you want to get into the pop versions of this, all those Hellraiser movies the power of the evil is there. Or, you know, I mean, it's ambiguous in Star Wars whether the dark side of the Force is something like this, even though, you know, at the end in the Return of the Jedi, the light side wins out.
Yeah, and of course, and for just average person who really isn't thinking about it, just simply the Satan.
Oh yeah,
theology is enough there. Generally, most traditions will talk about Satan being, or Lucifer being, an angel who rebelled and who truly isn't equal to God. But certainly, they explain the existence of evil in the world by these competing forces.
Yeah, and furthermore, if you go with Augustine, you have the idea that good. Goodness or evil is simply the lack of goodness. And so after the fall, where the world, the universe is sinful and evil, and in that sense, God isn't allowing evil to happen. Rather, God is trying to go in and push good onto this evil world.
It's an attempt there to avoid the dualism of Augustine. He was a Manichaean when he was a kid. He's trying to get away from that by saying evil isn't. You know, it's
right.
It is not. It's a lack of being.
Exactly. Yeah. Good. Well, I'm excited for. I think we've thrown out pretty good vocabulary, pretty good sense of. You know, again, the classical problem becomes a logical problem when you assert all the omnis as well as the existence of evil, and then certainly the free will defense and the soul making defense all play along with a little bit of dualism, play in the Mormon mindset and whatnot. Let's do this if we can. Lloyd and Jim, and again, Jennifer, please jump in at any time here, but, you know, and play the role of the student, you know, if you haven't had the philosophy class in a long time, you know, do whatever you want to.
Sure.
But what are the major critiques of, let's say, the free will defense and the soul-making defense, and especially I want to set us up for the difference that we're going to get in Mormonism, where God doesn't self-limit, you know, for the greater good. So can you kind of like at least push us in the typical critiques of those classical defenses?
All right. Well, for the free will defense, two of the main critiques you have is, one is just, why wouldn't God create people who freely do good all the time? And basically says, look, you know, if we can choose, why doesn't God, you know, create us so that we choose good? Give us there's clearly people in the world who are by habit or by their own moral their own morals, who generally do and do choose wisely and choose good, and there's those who choose evil. And so why doesn't God make people so that they're more likely to choose good, at least? And the other criticism, what I think is a stronger criticism, is that it just doesn't seem – it doesn't. That's not how we work in the world. You know, we could say – you could say, oh, well, God allows this person to kidnap – you know, a girl's being kidnapped and being raped, and God allows it because he wants to allow that free will to happen. But from our own sense, if I were to ever see that going on and I had the ability to save this girl, but I said, well, I'm going to hold back and I don't want to interrupt and hurt this guy's freedom, because that's such a strong good. I don't want to go in there and hurt his free will. We would look at that with disgust. And yet the theodicists want to say, or the free will defender wants to say, look, that is exactly what God is doing. And so I think that's one of the more stronger critiques of the free will defense, is it just, you know, do we really – perhaps if we need freedom, but do we really need all that freedom? Because we're more than happy to restrict freedoms in our own dealings with others.
This is where, you know, the Mark Twain critique from The Mysterious Stranger, but especially Ivan Karamazov's famous, you know, Grand Inquisitor and Rebellion section from Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov. You know, the Grand Inquisitor says, well, gee, you know, this is nice that God judges us this way, but God never had to be judged this way. God is all-powerful and perfect by definition. You know,
it was easy for God to resist those temptations.
Easy for God to for Christ to resist those three temptations of bread, of security and power, because God's never hungry, God's not insecure, and God doesn't lack power. One of the problems, too, is if we take it from the you know, the beautiful picture that there is no evil, suffering seems to be rather badly distributed. You know, some people seem to have a lot of it, some others don't have any. One of, I think, interesting examples of this was, remember when James Hagee, you know, he's that preacher from down in Texas, said that God sent Katrina to New Orleans because there were so many gays in New Orleans.
Right.
And but you know, that means God has notoriously bad aim, because he missed the French Quarter and hit the, you know, poor parts of town where, you know, people were Christian. You know, there's a real problem with the distribution of suffering in the world.
And And Jennifer can help us with that a little bit with some of her clients.
Yeah, Jennifer, there were a couple of things that you wrote about. You know, when I was thinking about this idea of distribution, you wrote about one of your colleagues' clients who had grown up, was abused as a child, and that's quite a story.
Mm-hmm. Wondering, do you want me to tell it?
Yeah.
You want me to tell it? Sure. So he, you know, he was adopted into a family, and then the family was adopted into, the mother was mentally ill and the father was largely absent. And so the mother was in and out of mental institutions, and the babysitter sexually abused him for years. And he was LDS, and so grew up with this deep sense of a secret, and, you know, got married trying to kind of do what his mother, who had lots of instability, wanted from him, trying to do what he believed the church wanted from him, and so on. And then he, you know, had same-sex attraction, and then, you know, in the course of a long-term marriage with kids, had several relationships. And so, you know, then his challenge, of course, is this of, who is God in my life? Because, you know, now facing church courts in the sense of wanting so much to belong to God and to belong to, and to feel like he's a legitimate human being, and in the face of the discipline of the church, feeling like, you know, God has betrayed me, and who is God, or who am I, essentially? Have I always been so disgusting to God that he hasn't cared for me and lent me a hand or helped me to know that I matter in some way? You know, or is God cruel? And, you know, and I have clients with similar challenges, of course, and it's hard to sit with those questions of, you know, how did God allow so much suffering to me when everyone else around me and the people judging me in the church court have not suffered the same realities at all or even close. So,
right.
You know, so it's just a big challenge in terms of thinking about the notion of who God is. And I think relative to my clinical work, I think that's an important question in our own moral development and the sense of self and who am I?
Right. And Lloyd, isn't what she's kind of saying there, it's one of the main critiques against theodicy, both free will and soul-making theodicy, in the sense of, okay, God, I can kind of see the purpose of free will, and it's the greater good, and boom, 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 and I can see soul-making, but all you really have to do is name one that clearly, you know, you've gone too far, or that's one evil too many. Couldn't you have accomplished the same purpose with such a lesser evil? So it's almost like this sort of unequal distribution of evil is definitely a piece of the critiques, isn't it?
Yeah, and going along with that, D.Z. Phillips, a lot of the theologians, a lot of those who want to hold up the free will defense, want to maintain a libertarian free will, and I like what D.Z. Phillips has to say about that. Where Phillips calls libertarian free will the ultimate sin of pride, and what he means by that is those who usually want to point to the free will defense to explain even situations like Jen just described want to say, well, that person had the choice to view these things differently. This person had the choice to take these trials in his life and make his life better. This person had the choice to abstain from certain things. He had all these choices. He just made wrong choices. And why Phillips calls that, well, I mean, it's kind of obvious why Phillips calls that the ultimate sin of pride, is because it holds this view that I would have done something differently if I was in that situation. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just, you know, when you look at the world and you, as you said, you look at this situation, just situations all over where people aren't built up by their trials but are just beaten down, you know, right. And they die after their trials, where there's just, you know, they're raped and killed. There's no right. Building their life in that process at all.
In the soul making theodicy, there's some people that attack that too. Let's just do that really quickly, and then let's move a little bit into where Mormonism sits in the middle of all this, because this is truly one of the places where Mormonism diverges from mainline Christianity and from classical theism. So I want to make sure that we lay that out. But what's the main angles that people take on soul making?
Coming from the Augustinian point of view, somebody like Charlie Matthews at University of Virginia will attack it as being much too optimistic, as being, you know, just some of the critiques that Lloyd just gave, as justifying all sorts of evil because, you know, that we need that to make our souls. Sometimes you hear people talk about church, this in church, that these are all just tests sent to us by God to make us stronger. So, you know, the soul-making theodicy, you know, that's one way that it's attacked.
Yeah, I mean, because you could say if someone wants to make the claim that God only allows evils and suffering if he knows those are going to result in greater goods, then I, to a certain extent, have a moral obligation to not interfere with that. Because if God wants this person to starve for some morally great reason, then if I jump in there and prevent that suffering, then I'm somehow intruding on God's will here. Right. I'm actually making the world less good by interfering. And the more or you can even take it to its logical conclusion that if I go in, and it sounds horrible, but if all evils that God allows result in greater goods, then I could create the best world possible by going into a Walmart and beating people with baseball bats, because either God's going to allow that for greater goods or God's going to stop me and so it won't happen anyways. And it's, when you take it to its logical conclusion, it just starts to seem absurd.
And there's a process critique of this too, because and this is something we haven't really brought up, what soul-making theodicy still maintain is that God created the world ex nihilo. God, in that sense, you know, God created it out of nothing. All of the kind of traditional theodicies do this. But you still have the problem that God did not need to create the world, that God created it with all its suffering and with all these people who are going to end up in hell.
Mm-hmm.
Why? You know, not out of any need, but out of just somebody, people will say, you know, there are ways that people defend this and very articulately by saying out of an abundance of love. God was just overflowing with love, and that's how the world came to be. But still, there seems to be a choice here, at least on God's part, and that the world adds nothing to God. So we didn't have to be here doing what we're doing.
Good, good.
And let me just add one more thing with soul building, and that's something I didn't touch on yet, and that's the eschatological end, the afterlife. And it's the idea that, well, yes, there's all the suffering, but in the end, God is going to make everything okay. We'll be in heaven, and we'll realize that it all wasn't really that bad to begin with. It'll seem small in comparison. We won't even remember it anymore. The Stephen Davis, who is a pretty well-known Christian theologian, you know, he got ragged on because he used the example of when he was in school and his mom bought him some pair of pants that were out of fashion and he had to wear them to school and he felt so embarrassed and felt so terrible and it was just, you know, the worst that could ever happen to him. And then, you know, now that he's in his older ages, he looks back on that and it's insignificant. And he says, well, that's just similar to what's going to go on with people who face any kind of trials and challenges and suffering and pain, is that once they get to heaven, they'll look back and feel like, oh, it wasn't that big of a deal. It really wasn't that, not, it's nothing to worry about anymore.
Yeah, so if you had the whole, it's like Augustine, if you saw the whole picture the way God does of the black as mm-hmm. is just as important as the light, in this case, you know, the big picture makes this all feel okay.
Yeah, you'll be so happy in heaven, you won't worry about what happened to you.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.